BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 133, and it's for April 16th, 2012. Oh, that's Monday, by the way. Monday, April 16th, 2012. I'm actually recording this Sunday evening. I just got off the telephone. I was calling in on the Freedom Fiends live Sunday call-in show for the single purpose of harassing Michael W. Dane and listening to Nima Vedati laugh, because I couldn't let the opportunity go by. But I wanted to do that before I got on here and got the podcast taken care of. It was just too sweet of an opportunity to hassle Michael W. Dane. And here's just a real quick free commercial for the Freedom Fiends. They have a regular podcast show that they do once a week. And you can find that over at Freedom Fiends, F-E-E-N-S, freedomfiends.com. They have a once-a-week podcast, and then they also have their Sunday live call-in show that's broadcast on the LRN network, the Liberty Radio Network. And that's at lrn.fm, where also badquaker.com podcast is broadcast. So, podcast is broadcast. Anyway, so yeah, so... Well, anyway, we're starting out a new week here, even though I'm cheating and getting the podcast done a few hours early. I did want to cover a couple things. We're getting close to our one-year anniversary podcast here at badquaker.com. And for anyone, people have asked, I'm not sure if or when Kai will be back on the podcast with me. I'm hoping she'll come back for the one-year podcast. She's got a pretty hectic life right now, and she's pretty busy going in a lot of different directions trying to get everything straightened out in her life. So I'm not sure if she'll be able to get back on the podcast with me or not, but it sure would be nice if she can make it back for the one-year anniversary podcast. Along those same lines, it's funny when you start to think of a sentence in your mind and your brain just puts the words in a different order than they ought to come out. But anyway, I've gotten some emails specifically in the realm of relationships that would work very well in a podcast with Kai. For any of the new listeners, Kai, my sometime podcasting partner here, is also my daughter, and we used to say pretty frequently that we were the only father-daughter anarchist or anarcho-capitalist podcasting team on the radio, so, or any variation of that statement. We've done quite a few relationship type stuff, and we did a whole series on the family and raising a non-aggressive family and so forth. So some of these questions are kind of echoes from those podcasts. One of them, though, was specifically in regards to having a relationship with a person who's not necessarily in the same, this is a male-female relationship with a person who's not really in the same category liberty-wise. You know, you might have an anarchist and a minarchist, or an anarchist and just a libertarian, or a libertarian and a right wing, or a libertarian and a left wing, or whatever. And I know I've heard a lot of different people in the liberty movement comment how difficult it is to have a relationship with someone who is not politically aligned, that they're not moving in the same political direction. And I understand that. I think for me, I'm coming from a totally different point of view, because my wife, we've been married now 32. It'll be 32 years this year at our anniversary in November. Will be 32 years, And, you know, we've been through some really crazy stuff. And my wife has very little interest in politics of any kind. She never really has. So now that would be, it might be different if she was, you know, really strongly right or really strongly left or really strongly something or other. And then I'm in the position that I'm in. I might have a completely different story, but from my point of view, having her not really all that interested in any kind of political theory of any kind, or not really interested in politics, it really hasn't been any kind of a burden on us at all. You know, she's better educated than I am. She has held down a career longer, you know, more consistently than I ever could. So it's not a matter of intelligence or worldly wisdom or experience or anything like that. It's just that she just doesn't have any interest in those things. So we don't have a problem. Now, with my mother and father, my father was a party Democrat who tended, on a theoretical level, to think and speak like a libertarian, but he was very much tied into the Democratic Party. It's not that he would never cross over and vote out of the Democratic Party. He did quite often, but he tended to fall back into the party line as part of his club. He was, you know, a lot, especially in that generation. He grew up during the Depression, and he was came to maturity at the very beginning of World War II. And so it was very much, and the culture of Eastern Kentucky that he grew up in was very divided along party lines too. It was, not only did the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, not only were they very politically divided, but they were socially divided. There were whole churches divided. You know, there was not a lot of association among the two different groups. So that was the culture that my dad grew up in. Now, my mom, on the other hand, was a Republican, and she was a party Republican, but she was also extremely conservative, in the old style conservative, not in the George W. Bush, Mitt Romney type. She's been passed away for many years now, but she would have never had anything to do with those people. Back in the day, she couldn't stand, you know, old Papa Bush back when. So I know she wouldn't have any tolerance for Baby Bush. But she was the old right-wing conservative type, you know, a Ronald Reagan supporter going back into the 60s, where my dad hated Ronald Reagan. So, you know, and yet they were married, I don't know, 60-some years before my mom passed away. They had what in many ways might be considered a perfect marriage. They just, as opposite as they were, they worked, you know, they kind of left politics out of their discussions between themselves, and went on with raising children and having their life and enjoying the love that they both felt towards each other. So, you know, is it possible for a couple to have drastically opposite political beliefs and still make it work? Absolutely, yes. My parents are the prime example of that. With my wife, myself and my wife, we don't have the opposite beliefs. She really doesn't want to think about politics, and really it's very confusing to her and aggravating to her, and so she would just prefer to stay out of it. So that is a relationship that has worked very well for us for now almost 32 years. And I've known other people, you know, who I'm real close to people who, where the wife was a dedicated anarchist, hardline anarchist, and the husband was a very solidly libertarian minarchist. And yet, you know, they did very well, and they cooperated very well. And so, you know, it's not impossible. It may be more work, but, you know, how do you say this without sounding corny? Real love will find a way to work around these differences. And it's, and if you can get it out of your head that it's not about who's right or who's wrong, and it's more about, you know, there's no team anarchy, there's no team minarchist, there's no team libertarian. If you realize that the couple, if they really love each other, they're the team, that's the only real team that matters, then you can put politics aside and still have that relationship. Now, not everybody can do that. And specifically, if you've got such a variation between the two that that there's just no possible way that you can stand on common ground, then I can certainly see how you couldn't allow yourself to be attached to someone like that. But each relationship is different, and I just wanted to throw out the examples of myself and my wife and my parents as examples. You know, let me throw out one more too. I know my mother and father-in-law, they're both passed now, but they had a very unique relationship in the case that neither of them spoke with the other about politics. So they both went their whole lives keeping their political ideas very private and not really sharing them with each other. And I always thought that was a little odd, because they were very private about, even when I talked to them separately, they were very private about their political beliefs. But it was kind of an oddity. But they were wonderful people, and they got along. Just they were the picture of a perfect couple. You know, they had trouble just like everybody else had troubles. My wife and I have had troubles, and my mother and father had troubles. But that's part of, you know, that's part of being the husband and wife team and facing the difficulties of life and everything that comes with it. Okay, well, that was not exactly, you know, I doubt that most of the audience is tuning in here for the libertarian lifestyle family relationship podcast. So, but because, and if any new listeners are listening and they're about to log off right now because they're like, I didn't want to hear the relationship podcast, don't worry. We're not normally. This is just a detour I stepped over onto there. Just to deal specifically with closing some of the emails and some of the discussions regarding that topic so that we can kind of move on. Now, I did want to talk about something that's maybe a little bit more controversial, and I don't want to really spend a lot of time on this, but I do want to touch it. I do want to touch on the topic. There's a wonderful website that I try to check at least once a week. It's called Daily Anarchist, and it's really easy to find it. It's just the word dailyanarchist, then .com. And of course, as always, I'll try to put a link to the article that I'm specifically talking about. I'll try to put a link to that article on badquaker.com, where this podcast appears in the notes for this podcast. But Davey Barker over at Daily Anarchist wrote this article, and I try to check Daily Anarchist about once a week, and I'll try to then go through and look through the older articles for the past week, and I don't actually read all of them, but I try to glance through, catch the best ones, and there's always a couple good articles every week at Daily Anarchist. But for some reason, when I logged on to just scan through, the very first one I hit was Davey Barker's article, and it had just published. I mean, it was just it must have only been an hour or two old, because when I read through it, I got to the end and there were no comments yet. So I commented, and my comment was the very first comment, which is rare to happen to me. But anyway, so the topic. The name of the article is The Lucifer Effect, Ron Paul, and the Stanford Prison Experiment. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Stanford Prison Experiment, let me give you just a real quick rough overview. This was, I would have to look through the article to see when this took place. It sticks in my mind that this was late 60s, early 70s when they did the experiment. I don't see it right off. I haven't actually read about it in some time, but the article references it and explains what the experiment was and what the in the context and everything. And it's really better to read the article than to hear my explanation anyway. But essentially, the Stanford Prison Experiment was done at Stanford University, and it was done with student volunteers. And some of them were prison guards in the experiment, and some were prisoners in the experiment. And the researcher who did the experiment then began to study the effects of both having the authority of the prison guards and being under authority, and studying the reaction of the students who were, playing the role of the prisoners. And the researcher had to stop the entire process after only a few days because the researcher himself realized that he was falling into a really bad role that he couldn't control. And he realized, well, okay, awkward pause. So if you're a regular listener of badquaker.com, you know that when sometimes I record these in the middle of the night, early in the morning, and sometimes I record them during the daytime, this one being recorded Sunday evening for the Monday morning publishing, oftentimes when I record these during the day, I end up getting interrupted. And that was the case just now. The phone rang, and it was my dad, and he's quite elderly, and I can't ever not take a call when he calls. It's every moment that I can spend with him is precious. So I had to interrupt the recording and talk to him, and that's always a pleasure. My dad is, I've talked about him before in the podcast, he has had an amazing life, and he's an amazing individual, but he's really a very, very feeble shell of the great man that he once was. Both, and I say great, I mean that in all sincerity, physically amazing strength for an individual, and then in addition to that, an engineering mind that as my regular listeners know, I've worked in advanced engineering in the aerospace industry, worked with NASA, contracting for defense contractors and so forth and so on. I've known really, really smart engineers, but I've only known one that really amazed me with his intelligence, and that was my dad. Now, and that's not taking away. I worked with some engineers at NASA, not NASA employees, I might add, but contract engineers that were in the division that just like I was where I was working, that were just amazing. I would think what an honor it was for me, with my level of education and my level of experience, to be working with people of such phenomenal brilliance. But all I'd have to do to really come back to earth again, so to speak, is just spend some time in a machine shop with my dad, and I would realize that he was a notch above anything that they could produce. But anyway, so that's way off the topic. I started to talk about the article over at Daily Anarchist, and I got a part of the way into explaining about the Stanford Prison Experiment when the phone rang. So hopefully I can pick this back up and make some sense out of it and not sound like a complete rambling idiot. So the Stanford Prison Experiment was shut down by the researchers because they started seeing how horribly dangerous it was turning and how nasty it was turning, that the people who were designated as prison guards were just right before their eyes, they were turning into monsters, and the volunteer students who were playing the part as prisoners were just melting and becoming total victims, and so they shut the process down. Now, then the writer of this article at the Daily Anarchist, Davey Barker, goes on to talk about the book The Lucifer Effect, which is an explanation of the experiment itself And then there's a lot of information in regards to things like the that horrible situation that happened at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And there's discussion about that. And it's really a good article. You get through close to the end, and then the point comes in about Ron Paul. And let me just read a very small section here. I'm not going to read it all. I'm not going to read the whole article. But it's really worth the read. I want to read this one part here, though. It says, "What Zimbardo has shown is that all of us, given the right circumstances, are capable of monstrous acts. So why would I want to put a loved one in those circumstances? People often call America the great experiment. In reality, it's another prison experiment. The only difference is we elect our wardens. If Zimbardo's thesis is correct, it doesn't matter whether the warden and the prison guards are elected, appointed, or selected at random. We often mistakenly think that evil people are attracted to power, but that's not what the research suggests. The studies show that power draws the evil out of people." And I'm not going to read the rest of it. I just wanted to give you an idea of that. And I want to point out that, and I said this in my notes, it's important to realize that the writer here is not saying that Ron Paul, given the opportunity, would turn into some kind of a monster. What the writer is saying is that they have too much of a love for Ron Paul to intentionally place him into a position where he'll feel the kind of pressures that a person would feel in the presidency. And again, they're not saying that Ron Paul would turn into some kind of an evil baby killer, you know, sending drones to kill wedding parties and doing all the evil things that we've seen other presidents do. They're not, the writer's not saying that Ron Paul would do that, but what the writer is saying is that it's a really cruel thing to intentionally put a person into that position. And then the comments down below, some of them are quite comical. You read the comments and they're like, "Why do you want anarchy? People would kill each other. Wah wah wah." And you think, did you not notice that the website you're on is Daily Anarchist? You know, somebody got Ron Paul in a search engine and they fell upon the Daily Anarchist, read this article, didn't understand it, and then go into some wild arm flailing attack against anarchy, having absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of the, you know, of the theory or of what it's based on or anything else. It's just, I don't understand when people on the internet do that. But anyway, but the author, Davy Barker, adds to the comments, commented upon my comment, and they said, Davy Barker's comment in the comments, "I realize that I can only support Ron Paul for president if I dehumanize him and think of him as a fictional character in a crappy game show. If I met with Ron Paul face-to-face, heart-to-heart, as equal human beings, I would advise him to serve as president of the Free State Project, if Carla can be queen." That's sort of an inside joke for the Free State people. "Or as a writer for something like Freedom's Phoenix, or even Return to Medicine, or anything but to take the power of others." And that's really, you know, I want to throw in the Lord of the Rings reference here real quick, just to sort of get the geek crowd going. But in the premise of Lord of the Rings, and I should say, first off, that J.R.R. Tolkien went to great effort on a number of occasions to state that he was not writing Lord of the Rings trilogy as some kind of a political statement. And yet, it's almost impossible not to have some kind of a political statement written into something as the kind of a huge work that Lord of the Rings is. It's kind of like, J.R.R. Tolkien's good friend, C.S. Lewis, The two of them, if you know very much about them and their little club of people that they hung around with, they would sit at the pub and discuss things, everything from theology to politics to, you know, writing to everything, news, current events. They would discuss things for hours and hours and hours at the pub together. And so it's really kind of illogical to think that any of them could write something as masterful and as complete as Lord of the Rings or as any of the big C.S. Lewis works and not have some kind of theological and political position in mind. And then if you start reading some of C.S. Lewis's statements about governance and so forth, and then you read Tolkien's statements about how government should never be written with a capital G and how who the kind of people that government attracts, and you start to see an insight that, and then also in addition to everything I just said, you realize that in the days that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were writing and when they were hanging out in the pubs together and really putting these things all within their foundational framework before they really wrote the kind of works that made them famous, there were really no prominent writers, especially in England, that were laying this entire thing out as we know it today as anarcho-capitalism. There was no Murray Rothbard writing these things back then. Murray was, you know, a very small child at the time. You know, Mises was writing in economic theory, which who knows if Tolkien would have even known if he existed or not. But, you know, certainly an Austrian economist, an actual Austrian citizen who was an economist and a professor, may not have held the slightest interest to somebody like Tolkien or C.S. Lewis. So for Tolkien to say, yes, there was no politics, what he was talking about was English politics of the day. But yet, at the same time, you look at the analogy of the Lord of the Rings and you see that the main point of the entire trilogy and bleeding back into the prehistory of Lord of the Rings that comes out through the Silmarillion and the whole storyline and everything that Tolkien put together. And the point, his major point through the whole thing was that an individual cannot hold the ring of power and not be changed by it. An individual cannot embrace the kind of power that comes, the kind of authority, the kind of, you know, with people placing you into that kind of position, you can't touch the ring and not be changed by it forever. And so in the Lord of the Rings story, you know, the Gandalf, the wizard, refused to touch it at all. He didn't want anything to do with it because he understood what would happen if he just touched it. And so the only people that could be trusted to touch it, and you're not going to see this in the movies so much because the movies sort of had to portray them, portray the hobbits as these lovable people. But if you actually read Tolkien, you know, one of the lovable aspects of the hobbits were that they were simpletons. And so, you know, maybe the only people that can be trusted on a temporary basis with the reins of power is a complete simpleton. On the other hand, if that simpleton holds the power very long, it changes them in a very, very negative fashion. And one thing to keep in mind for the Tolkien people that are following along on this, and everybody else is bored stiff right about now, but one thing to keep in mind is that the Gollum character was once a hobbit. And that's what the power will do to a person. And that is exactly what Tolkien was referring to through the whole thing. That's what power does to you. You have to reject that centralized power. And that is the only way to really have freedom. Okay, I'm going to break off from this, and we're going to have our commercial. And when we get back from I have no co-host. I'm here by myself. Not even Baggy the Cat is with me. So when I get back from this commercial break, we'll pick back up on a different topic altogether. So stick with me. Be right back. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time?
I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And let's see if we can get back to the show here. And I'll get back to my notes. One last word on the article at the Daily Anarchist. I just want to encourage you, get over to badquaker.com, click the link for that'll be on the page where this podcast appears, and you'll see the link there for the Daily Anarchist. Click that link, get over and read that article, The Lucifer Effect, Ron Paul and the Stanford Prison Experiment. And especially if you're not familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment, it's a really good explanation of that, and so it's worth reading the article just for that information alone. But it's a really good article, and there's a ton of information in the Stanford Prison Experiment for us to learn from as minarchists and anarchists and libertarians, and specifically. The point made by the author about Ron Paul, I think, is particularly touching because it's really emphasizing a love for Ron Paul and not wanting a bad thing to happen to him. And I've expressed that myself about Ron Paul. You know, I expressed the fear that, and I don't think at all that the Republicans will allow Ron Paul to take the nomination. But I've expressed the fear, too, that knowing how the inner workings of the Republican Party are, if he were to somehow magically take the nomination, I'm afraid they would just kill him. It wouldn't be the first time, and probably won't be the last time that they've done something like that. But I believe that the main string pullers in the upper echelon of the Republican Party would rather kill him than risk him actually coming into power. But okay, and so for that reason, I can't support him. I can't be involved in anything that would bring harm to Ron Paul. So, now I promised I'd move on and get to the other part of the notes, so we need to get to that. Before I get into the main part of my notes, though, I did want to recap something from the other day from my from my podcast called The Inevitability of the Police State, Part 4. That was, I think, last Friday's podcast episode. And in that, I talked about the Katrina cops, that the one particular group of five Katrina cops that had shot those people on the bridge, the unarmed people that were just trying to get help and they had been stranded, and they were hungry and scared, and they were trying to get over to the football dome over there where they could get help. And they were crossing a bridge, and some cops panicked and shot them down. And now after, and this happened in, keep in mind, Katrina was, what, 2005? Yeah, September of 2005 that this took place. And finally, 7 years, 6.5 years later, finally we're in the sentencing phase of this. And some of the cops involved in the cover-up got away pretty much scot-free. One cop ended up with, he was allowed to retire early, and then he was given a small sentence so that he'll be able to come out of prison and still collect his retirement. And some of the other cops were punished ridiculously hard. Well, not ridiculously hard, considering they actually killed people, but ridiculously hard sentences compared to what others involved, how they walked away almost scot-free. Either way, it was just a horrible mess of convoluted, just nonsense. And one of the things to keep in mind as you think about all of this mess is a very old phrase in law. This is well known within legal circles. And that is, justice delayed is justice denied. Now, there's a reason why, and if you're a regular listener, you know I'm not a big fan of the Constitution, but there's a reason why a speedy trial, the right to a speedy trial, is put in the Constitution. There's a reason it's in there. That is because it's well known, and it's a well-established fact, and it's well understood, especially by those who have any legal experience whatsoever. This is a very, very old principle that justice delayed is justice denied. Now, so when the writers of the Constitution put that into the Constitution, because the Constitution is so useless and worthless and actually counterproductive, but when they put it into the Constitution, they made it one-sided. So, for example, in the case of the Katrina cops, the Katrina cops have the right to a speedy trial. On the other hand, the Katrina cops, being the guilty jerks that they are, had every reason to delay as long as possible. And so they did. So their attorneys would agree to a delay and ask for a delay and agree to a delay and ask for a delay until the thing could be stretched out year after year after year. And why would they want that? Because if you're guilty, the last thing you want is justice. So here's another flaw in the Constitution. The speedy trial aspect of the Constitution is only one-sided. It only takes into consideration the accused, and it assumes that the accused is innocent. Well, that's all fine and good unless the accused is not innocent, and it entirely leaves out the victim in the case. So, could you possibly have justice if you drag a murder trial out for that many years? Well, for the victims, the families of the victims, there can be no justice when you drag it out that many years. And for someone who's actually guilty of murder, dragging it out for years is the perfect thing they'd want to do. They want to delay going to jail as long as possible. They want to drag the sentencing process out. They want to drag out every aspect of it as long as possible, so that the heat and the passion of the moment and the memory, the fresh memory of dead people laying on a bridge, so that wears away in the mind. It's easier to compromise, and it's easier to come to a softer decision the longer you put these things off. So once again, this is an aspect of failure of the Constitution, because the Constitution wrote into it certain so-called rights that are going to protect the innocent accused, but they do nothing to protect the victims of the accused, and they do nothing to protect justice itself under the case of where the person accused is actually guilty. So once again, the Constitution fails in that regards. And keeping in mind that it's within the preamble of the Constitution to establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility. And like I said in my last podcast, if there's no justice, there can be no domestic tranquility. Domestic tranquility entirely depends on the existence of justice. And if justice is not provided, if justice is delayed, if justice cannot be obtained, then you cannot have domestic tranquility. And justice delayed is justice denied. Okay, now let's get away from that for a moment. And let's talk about something entirely different. But yet, at the same time, it's the same thing. Because right there in the preamble it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare. Now, what in the world could that mean? Well, you know, it's possible to go back and find out what it is they're talking about. But by wording it in the vague fashion that they did, they made it possible for later generations to come in and use that welfare clause, that's what that's referred to generally as the welfare clause, use that welfare clause to do pretty much anything they want to with it. Okay, so now let's consider some things. So then the government starts getting involved in things like the monetary supply and the value of gold and all the shenanigans that they were pulling in the 1800s and coming up into 1900, and when they finally get their Federal Reserve established, and then they start implementing Bismarck-like policies in regards to public schools and public welfare programs and public assistance programs, and they start bringing all these Bismarck and let me just back up for a minute. Bismarck being the German individual who is most credited with uniting a very fragmented, very libertarian Germany, bringing that all together into one state, into a proper state. Prior to Bismarck, Germany was not a true state. It was a collection of it was a confederacy of small, very loosely organized states, but certainly not any kind of, in any way, like a modern state. And that was good. There was commerce. There was a lot of really strong aspects of Germany that were based upon its loose confederacy. But Bismarck envisioned an empire like England and like France and like Russia. And that's what he wanted to produce, and that's what he did produce. And part of his process in doing this depended on subduing the people. It was imperative that Bismarck subdue the people in order to pull this off. And so how did he subdue the people? Well, one of the ways that he subdued the people was to introduce things like a minimum wage and welfare and unemployment and health benefits and all these socialist or progressive ideas that so many people fight about here in the United States. Those were all part of Bismarck's plan to break the will of the people, to allow the people, or to so that the people would allow a unification of Germany and a loss of their individual rights. That was the whole purpose in it. And I might say that the biggest waves of German immigrants to the U.S. came at the same time that the people of Germany were attempting to escape this statification of Germany, because so many people realized that their rights were being trampled and that Germany was changing and that the old Germany was dying and the freedoms and the liberty that they had been accustomed to in Germany were evaporating with Bismarck's unification. And so they, in waves, they came to the United States seeking liberty. And here in the United States at the time, these Bismarck plans had not been implemented yet. It wouldn't be for years until the progressives really came into a position of power in the U.S. where they could begin to implement Bismarck stuff. So then, as the U.S. became more and more progressive, so we get into a position where the government starts to control things like minimum wage, and they start having all these different things. Now, I want to jump ahead to the current situation in the U.S. That's all just a sort of a historical, not really even a very well outlined, just more or less of a history rant. But so we're stuck with certain things. We're stuck with the minimum wage. We're stuck with Social Security. We're stuck with these different things like this, Medicaid, food stamps, all these different government programs that pollute and distort the economy. All right, and then the powers that be in government tell us that inflation is, oh, what are they saying now? I can't remember, 3% or something like that. I think they're claiming that inflation is around 3% or 4% or something. But if you use real numbers and you use the measuring system that they used to use, like back in the 1980s and back in the 1970s, if you use the old method of measuring inflation, then inflation in 2011 was over 10%, about 10.5%. And we're looking at a similar thing in 2012. And the funny thing is, now we're told that minimum wage and Social Security benefits and food stamps and Medicaid and all these different programs are supposed to be adjusted for the economy. So, for instance, if the government does their little number game and they say, well, inflation's at 3%, then what they will then do is they will give all the Social Security recipients a 3% increase each year. And they will give the Medicaid a 3% increase and food stamps a 3% increase and federal employees get a 3% increase on their retirement. And, you know, all these different people who glean their income from the government, the theory is everybody gets a 3% increase because there's 3% inflation. And that way everybody stays equal. Well, the problem is if they cheat on the numbers and they say we're having 3% inflation when in fact we're having 10% inflation. Now think about this for a minute. What is inflation? Inflation is the value of the dollar is the creeping loss in value of the dollar. So for instance, inflation compared to say 1912, when the Federal Reserve was established, up until today, is something in excess of 99% inflation. So, for example, something that would have cost you, I'll just take a random commodity, something that would have cost you like $20 in 1912, today costs something in the range of $1,600. I'm using gold as a specific the specific commodity there, but you can use pretty much any commodity. You can use different food items. You can use gasoline. There's a variety of relatively stable commodities that you can compare the dollar to and realize that the dollar has lost in excess of 99% of its value in the last 100 years due to this inflation. A handful of corn is still a handful of corn. A slab of bacon is still a slab of bacon, but the dollar that buys it has lost its value consistently over time due to inflation. So that's really what inflation is. It's when there's more and more money dumped into the system and that money is worth less and less. So now if we're told that inflation is at 3%, but the real number is 10.5%, then that makes a dramatic difference in the value of those dollars. And so if you're an old person who's, you know, retired and you're living on your Social Security, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. None of what I'm saying should be taken in a way to assume that I'm saying Social Security is good or Medicaid is good or food stamps are good or minimum wage is good or any of those government manipulations of the economy. I'm not saying any of those things are good, but they're the reality that we face today. So then, a person who's drawing Social Security, they're 70 years old or whatever, they're living on their Social Security, and the government says, well, we had 3% inflation last year, so we're giving you a 3% raise. But the problem is, there was really over 10% inflation. Then you're not getting a raise. What you're actually getting is you're getting a cut in your wages. In real money, in real value for the dollar you're getting, that 70-year-old person who's depending on Social Security just got a wage cut. They cannot buy as the same quantity of food that they could buy before. the same quantity of energy. They're not going to be able to buy gasoline or heat their homes or do whatever it is that they're going that they would normally do with their money. They are looking at a dramatic loss of the value of their money. Yeah, they got a 3% raise. They got more coming to them in their Social Security checks, but the check is worth less every month. And the difference between a 3% inflation and a 10% honest inflation is pretty dramatic if you start adding it up over a few years. And the funny part about specifically Social Security, Social Security went several years with no increases at all. And then for 2012, they gave like a 3.6% increase in Social Security. But that's after several years of 10% of real inflation. Or worse. Some people are estimating inflation back around 2008 and 2009 to be closer up into the 12, 14, and some are even saying 18% inflation. But even if we go with the conservative numbers of 10% inflation, if there was 10% inflation for 5 years running, and you gave zero increases during several of those years, and then finally you give a 3.5% increase, you have dramatically lowered the income of all those retirees. And this doesn't just go for old people that are on Social Security. This goes for disabled people. This goes for the poor that are depending on food stamps. It goes for Medicaid. Now, let me give you some numbers so that you can kind of get a grasp of how many people we're really talking about here. This is all coming from .gov websites, so I'm not going to give links to all of them. But all the numbers are out there. It's not hard to gather this stuff. So, you know, if you think I'm lying, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast anyway. But it's all this stuff is out. I got all this stuff from .gov websites, and I really don't want to link to them on Bad Quaker. But anyway, so we're looking at federal minimum wage has not changed since 2009. So that means everybody depending on minimum wage, even though there's been 10% or more inflation a year, they haven't got a raise. Okay? If you look under all occupations for wage increases on average, the average wage increase in the U.S. in 2011 was 0.1%. So this is just in 2011. The average wage increase was 0.1% at the same time that the real inflation rate was over 10%. So what that really means is if you got a 0.1% raise in 2011, you actually got a 10% cut in your wage. Now that's what the real numbers mean. You got a 10% cut in 2011. Unless you got a 10% raise in your wage, then you just barely kept up with the economy. But if you'd got anything less than a 10% increase in your wages in 2011, you lost money. Your dollars are worth less than they were. Your wages are worth less. Now, there's some exceptions to this. I found that doctors that prescribe prosthetic limbs, excuse my pronunciation, they had a 25% on average. They had a 25% increase in their wages in 2011. Doctors that prescribe prosthetic, boy, my pronunciation. In other words, this is primarily a government-sponsored employment here the other was organizational psychologists received on an average 11% increase in their wages in 2011. Now, both these two professions are heavily government-sponsored because if you think about of late, one of the major recipients of prosthetic limbs is U.S. military returning from combat duty. And one of the major recipients of help from organizational psychologists were U.S. military returning from active duty in the Middle East. So the people, some of the people who gained the highest levels of increases in their wages in 2011 were people who were directly profiting off of the tragedies of our military engagements in the Middle East. Now, there were others who received dramatically high increases in their in their wages during 2011, specifically actors, entertainers, performers, agents, business managers, artists, and athletes were averaged near 5% increases for their wages. Of course, that's nowhere near the occupational psychologist, but according to National Review, and I try to stay away from them as much as possible, but they do have some statistics that were valuable. According to National Review, there are roughly 40 million Americans that are employed some way directly by the government. Now, that means that about 17% of the American labor pool, or one in every six workers, is directly paid by the government. This includes, you know, parks employees, you know, the TSA, all these different organizations, but it also includes direct contractors to government agencies. So people, and that's why the number is slightly different than you're going to see over at like whitehouse.gov or something, because National Review included people who are directly contractors to the federal government. So nearly 40 million Americans, or almost 20% of the workforce in America, is employed directly by government in the U.S. Now, according to CNN Money, again, not a place I like to hang out, but they do have some use in their website. According to CNN Money, one in six Americans is receiving help from the government, and that was in 2010, and that is not including Social Security recipients. We're talking about Medicaid and food stamps and different unemployment, different organizations like that where money is coming from the government going to Americans. They estimate that roughly 50 million Americans are on Medicaid, and about 45 million are receiving food stamps in some way. Now, according to SSA.gov, the Social Security Administration's website, in 2012, roughly 56 million Americans received Social Security benefits, so that's a little over 20%. So what we're looking at here is about 20% of Americans are directly paid by the government. About 20% of Americans receive either Medicaid or food stamps or some other kind of assistance from the government. And about another 20% of Americans receive Social Security benefits or disability benefits. Now, so what that means is that 60% of Americans receive money directly from the government in some way. Now, if you just take in addition to that, and you realize that major employers like General Electric, Pratt Whitney, Monsanto, these huge corporations that have Boeing, you can just keep going on. Most specifically, the ones that are either in the agribusiness or the ones that are in the defense aerospace contract business. And I realized there, that's my old stomping grounds, is the aerospace industry. But above and beyond all that, all those criticisms, those people, those industries are heavily subsidized or directly subsidized by the U.S. government. So when you start to realize how many of these people are either directly or indirectly funded by taxation, the number of people actually working and doing productive work is becoming a very minuscule point in the United States. We're getting to that point of where the upside down pyramid, where all of the dependence of society is based on a very small pocket of workers, a very small pocket of productive individuals that hold up all the rest of society. This is not an Atlas Shrugged thing where a couple of large rich people are holding up society. No, it's the opposite. Small businesses, small independent companies that are employing people to actually do productive things, that's what's holding up this economy. And when those people realize it, that the vast majority of their earnings are going to support this huge bureaucracy that hangs over their heads, when they realize that, things are going to change really quickly. So what part of the Constitution is it that you don't like? Well, I talked a lot about that, didn't I, in the last podcast, the last couple podcasts. Well, let me just end this podcast by reading something from Lysander Spooner. But whether the Constitution really be one thing or another, This much is certain, that it has either authorized such a government as we have had, or has been powerless to prevent it. In either case, it is unfit to exist. Lysander Spooner, No Treason, The Constitution, and No Authority. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com, and thank you very much for listening. Goodbye, folks.